Blog Talk Radio.
Coming to talk to him on that day, so he's going to be there
to get, you know, I guess in Bosnia now. It looks like I'm going back to Bosnia. They said, no, I wasn't going to go to Bosnia. Now I'm going to go to Bosnia and see the pyramids and whatnot. So I'm going to be, I know I'm going to be in Europe, you know, for over the first 2 weeks of August, more or less.
Right. So are you going to get, are you going to get a chance to go into these vaults now or under the pyramid?
I would not expect that. Number one, it is a tour, so, you know, it's like people aren't, you know, I'm going to be over there with my Romanian friend, Nicole, who's going to be the Romanian tour guide
right.
to negotiate.
She wrote about her in the book, I believe, right?
That's correct, and she's going to be there with me, and she's going to be my Romanian interface, because when you have to deal with certain things, it's a lot easier to have somebody who speaks the language. And I will be directing where to go, and I will be playing off of her, because I don't think she's been to this area before. But we're going back to the Sphinx. And when I was in this, the Transylvania Sunrise mentions my adventure to the Sphinx.
Right.
And there's another stone monument there called Babil, which means old woman in Romanian. I define it as a gateway. It's big rock formation. And in between that and the Sphinx is underneath the ground is where this secret chamber is supposed to be with the holographic Hall of Records. Now, there's other megaliths up there, but what I really didn't appreciate when I was there the first time is that the Sphinx and Babil are a starting point. They were the end destination my first time. There is a mountain, road,
right.
And I've been told various things. It's about a 2.5-hour walk to get to Mount Omu, which is the mountain, means the mountain of man. And when we say man,
this you wrote about in the second book, I believe. This is where everybody.
This is a different mountain. This is a different mountain than is mentioned in the second book. This is different. This is where we are going. And there's a whole trail there where there's ancient mountains, ancient, you know, a cave monastery, and various different things that are, you know, sort of a guardianship of an ancient civilization, and there's each one has a different story and a legend. And it said when you walk through this area for like a whole day, you're electromagnetically charged. You're not tired because of the electromagnetics of the area. So it's new to me. I mean, I have a lot of write-ups of what might be there and this sort of thing, but I'm actually going to see it. And what's important is actually walking by these ancient pathways. It's sort of like walking into a house before you buy it. It's like you're getting the beat of it, and it's going to be your future for the next, amount of years you're going to live in that house. I mean, that's a rough analogy, but this is what we're learning. And, of course, there'll be destinations to other areas, but that's the primary goal, is to go there and visit the Sphinx and then extend beyond. And I'm going there now with more knowledge of what that Sphinx actually represents in terms of what's underneath it. And with each repeating trip, I will learn more, I will find out more, and connecting with more people. I will try to meet with a director who has written a script for the first book he wants me to help him with in terms of getting a movie made for the first book, and my publisher, who is the one who has the main interface with Radu.
Oh, and this is the Hungarian publisher, right?
No, Romanian publisher.
Sorry,
there's
Romanian.
No Hungarians involved here.
Oh, okay.
Hungary is a very interesting story, because they used to occupy Transylvania, and they would claim that it's their original. Romania got it after the Crimean War. So, I mean, there's a lot of interesting history in Hungary, but it's not part of, and I'm very good friends with a Hungarian shaman who lives locally, Maria DeAndrea. And, you know, that's a whole other
part of Eastern
Europe I want to get into, but not on this trip.
I know that we, I'm looking at the diagram here of the tunnels, and it stated that, one goes to, there's three tunnels. One goes to Inner Earth, the other goes to Egypt, and the other goes to, I just lost the page.
Goes
here.
To Tibet.
Tibet,
and Peter,
right?
The third book is the tunnel to Egypt. Is that right?
It's going to be called whatever I decide to call it. As far as, you know, it's Egyptian mystery or mystery of Egypt. That's my choices. In Egyptian, it translates as, I mean, in Egyptian, in Romanian, as Egyptian mystery, the prime tunnel. I'm going to call it mystery of Egypt, the first tunnel. Prime is first in Romanian.
Okay, now I've got, and here it says the inner earth. That was the inner earth was tunnel one. Tibet was tunnel two, and Egypt was tunnel three. And the projection hall, I guess it was. There was an ambassador or somebody actually went into that central tunnel and to the inner earth. Did they ever get out of there, or did they ever come back?
Well, that's an interesting question, because that is. Cesar Brad, who is the focal point of book one, Transylvania Sunrise. He's born as a psychic with a, you know, thick umbilical cord, and they can't cut it, and he's monitored and groomed to be the head of Romania's Department Zero, and his ultimate mentor is Dr. Zen, who turns out to be a Tibetan Lama, Ripa Sunday, in the second book. And
right.
Cesar, after, you know, I was given... Radu wrote a letter to me, I think it was a couple of years ago, and said he was very sad that Cesar had left, he didn't have his mentor, and that he'd gone to become an ambassador to the beings in the inner earth. Now, and that was a mystery. Now, he had received a letter in earlier this year, and it said that they received a letter from Cesar, and they were very excited. But there was, I guess, certain authorities clamped down. They clamped down. It's like Caesar's somebody they can't control. They can't dismiss. They can't kill, but they can't control. You know, so there's a, they don't know how, I mean, they have to respect him. It's almost like he has the, you know, some sort of upper hand on them because of what his knowledge is, and they can't, you know, they can't trash him because they need his knowledge. So, speculating upon what I've read thus far, is that these beings in the inner earth would seem to be accessible through this tunnel, and at some point, according to what I've learned about the third book, there are some space-time distortion functions in the tunnels, to where these tunnels are said to be real and physically go to places, but it's my impression that they go into another realm, which would be much like the Shangri-La you've seen in the movie Lost Horizon.
Well, I wondered, based on the second book, about the Blue Goddess, now she was transdimensional, wasn't she?
The way it would appear, and she could manifest physically, because there was a physical manifestation to Radu and to the young kids in Transylvania who saw her, but if you remember the character in the book, the Yidam, who is physical, but he can disappear. I would imagine that she has at least that aspect to her, to where she can, you know, she's existing on a higher octave or a higher vibration than we are, so she can come down into this one and appear, and obviously interface. It's
For those people who are listening tonight and haven't read the book, is the Transylvanian Moonrise, but the first in a series was Transylvanian Sunrise. But in the Moonrise, in the Sunrise, we talk about the Sphinx, the discovery of the Sphinx, and the ancient culture there in the Hall of Records. But in the second book, we talk about he goes into a quite a different. The author was Radu Sinemar, and again Peter was the editor and a publisher of the book. But I think it's important because that was the first time I had ever heard of Yidam when I read your book, this book, and explain to people what a Yidam is and what Radu's journey really was. Yeah, you don't have to go into all detail, but what a spiritual journey he was taken on.
Yes, he's had a very unique initiation into the realm of spirituality, which he seems to be stumbling into when he gets involved with Caesar Brad. And
yeah.
after a whole indoctrination with Caesar Brad of learning things, he's taken to the holographic Hall of Records, where he sees this ancient technology by ancient beings, and is given a rather unique and rapid initiation into all things metaphysical. In the second book, he's meeting the Lama, and when the Lama arrives, he's accompanied, and we find out the Lama is Dr. Zen, the person who tutored Caesar as a doctor from Red China. But he's
right.
like Batman. He's got a double identity, and he's really a Tibetan Lama. And in the case of when he comes to meet Radu, he's accompanied by a strange creature who's very tall, about 7 feet, and he's very impressive.
Right.
It kind of reminds me of that guy Jaws from the James Bond movie, or Lurch, but I mean not so grotesque looking, but
yeah.
powerful like that, and uniquely dressed like he's from the Arabian Nights or something. But he is a Yidam, which the whole second chapter begins with the discussion of what is a Yidam, because the Lama does not want Radu to be freaked out by this. What in the heck is this thing in the living room here? So he starts explaining the nature of this Yidam, and he explains that this Yidam is created at a certain level of what I will refer to as Lamaism, which is the spiritual practice of the Lamas. And because Lamaism is much older than Tibetan Buddhists, much, much older, and the Buddhism is the later evolution of Lamaism. And so anyway, this at a certain level where you are not able to take your physical body into these other realms, you create with a San Mandela ritual. Many people have seen these beautiful San Mandelas that the monks create. This is they use a San Mandela ritual to create a Yidam, which is an extension of yourself or your mind, a higher functioning
right.
part of your mind.
Right.
And but it's actually a part of yourself, and it functions in dimensions where you could not go, and it can do things. It's a more senior partner in your ability to interface with the mysterious aspects of the universe. And that's what a Yidam is. And the Yidam is only used for a certain level. Beyond that, he's not needed anymore. But he's it's as if he has an automatic ability an ability to talk. He doesn't necessarily talk. But because that's a whole, he has to be taught how to talk. But he can interface and help you and do things with you. He can talk to you silently.
Right.
So,
now I have,
go ahead.
For those saying, this is not a book of fiction, by the way. These are actual happenings by to the author Radu Sinemar. And the amazing thing here. This brought me into some incredible stuff that I had touched on before, but I never knew of anybody who really experienced this kind of thing. But the Yidam appeared, but he was the go-between, really, between the spiritual world and the physical world. Is that correct?
That's a pretty good description. And his function, he is not a Yidam of the Lama, which is interesting. He works with the Lama. He's a Yidam of somebody else, which would seem to be preoccupied with protecting the manuscript that they retrieve in Tibet from
right.
the goddess Mashande. They receive a transcript from her, and that's the purpose
right.
of the visit.
Is that going to be revealed in the next book?
That will be book four.
Book four.
And it's called, I think, the Secret Parchment, Five
okay.
Tibetan Initiation Techniques, which they have five techniques, which are basically meditation techniques. And I can't say what they are. I can tell you that my new translator, who has been a very pleasant to work with when I first started talking to her, she spontaneously communicated to me. I've never met her. I don't know any of her friends or vice versa, but she was interested in the book and asked me to put it in ebook format, which was very curious to me because she's already got it in Romanian. They
right.
wanted to read my English, what else I put into it. So, but I asked her, I said, have, you know, she's read book three and book four. And she said, book four, I said, do you do the Tibetan initiation techniques? She kind of like, you know, she seemed a little guilty. No, I haven't. I haven't had the time to do them. And you know, so it's very important. I mean, I would assume it's very important to do them. I would assume they're beneficent. I haven't read them yet. But the one thing is that they get activated, whatever they are, and they're very key according to, you know, or she wouldn't be releasing them or telling people to do them. I can tell you that there are techniques called the Five Tibetans that are practiced in, I know I do them in Taoist Qigong. It's they're wonderful techniques to wake up the body. I don't know what hers are, and I'm interested to learn them. But and then it also will have stuff about activities going on in Department Zero in the fourth book. I've summarized them in some of the books. I've summarized what I've been able to learn from the publisher about them. I can tell you a little bit about the third book.
Okay.
If you want to go into that now or later.
Okay. I was curious, though, in this one, as to his talk with the god, with the blue goddess, and where she actually came from. If you could refresh me on this, I kind of forgot. I know that you went into the cave and whatnot, but she was of the blue race. Is that correct? Of the lost blue race.
Well, she's I've written about the blue race, and we've discussed it on your show before many times in different books, the Montauk Book of the Living. And it's very interesting that if you just look at my work as Peter Moon, independent of Radu, much of it has been about the blue race, the blue people who I have stumbled upon in my research, an ancient race. And
you had on the cover of the Montauk
Book of the Living.
Look at the living. You have this goddess on the front cover.
Yes, and if you look at the black sun, you've got a blue. If you look at the black sun, you've got a blue Tibetan lama on the cover of that one. So you know, I've got this consistency of blue people in my books. But now, and I was kind of intuiting, or maybe I would have liked to meet the blue goddess Antonea that I write about, the Queen of Atlantis. Well, this is a different one. This is Mashande, who appears in this book as a goddess talking to somebody that I know. And I haven't met him personally, but I know him. I've had special communications from him back and forth. He's very happy with the work I've done with these books, and he's familiar with my other stuff too.
But I think it's important to mention this. I'm just quoting from the Montauk Book of the Living here. I'm just looking at it. What you stated about the blue race, so people can understand more without having read the book. It says, the artifacts of history point to a mysterious blue race which founded the Egyptian culture and honored the feminine principle through the star Ceres, which was known as the Star of Women. And the descendants of these people are the Turag, or blue people, who reside in one of the most mysterious and intriguing strongholds left on Earth, the Agar Mountains in southern Algeria. All right?
That's correct,
I love that book, by the way. I was totally fascinated by it. But this any relation to the goddess that appeared to Radu?
Well, I would think that there has to be a relation to them. And, you know, that's a question I would better ask her if I ever get a chance to meet her. Even Radu, I don't know.
Chance of meeting Radu? Or?
Yes, there's a very good chance of meeting Radu. He wanted to meet me, it was a couple years ago, and he said he came very near my house. I think one of the books talks about his trip to New Mexico. He was in Maryland and he was doing something with remote viewing. I don't know whether he was learning it or teaching it. I think he was teaching it, but I really don't know. And he wanted to come by my house, he said, but he did not want to have problems caused for me. And
right.
So he didn't come. He later told me. And it's been my intuition is very good sometimes when I know it's working. I had predicted that David Anderson would come back into my life in a particular year. And it was a whole series of years. I said, this is the year of, this faction, that faction. Then it was the Moors, and then it was Romania or whatever. So I feel intuitively that when I finish the fourth book and I translate it and get it published, in other words, I've got all his works in the English language, that I will then meet with him. It will opportunity. It's possible I could see him, get tapped on the shoulder, and meet with him in Romania, but I don't think so because he's not comfortable meeting with me in Romania. But I think when the fourth book is written and published and translated, all this in English, I think that I will then have the opportunity to meet him, and that from that will ensue a fifth book. He's been prohibited from writing anymore, and for the time being. And so I think that, and then we will either write it together or we'll write two separate books. You know, he'll write a fifth and I'll write a fifth. That's what I think. Probably write it together.
Right.
And
yeah, that'll be cool.
To get back to your other question about Caesar, he is going to be returning. He has predicted that he will return and things will work out. Now, but Radu has said in his last letter to me that things have never been so tense politically. And in the third book, it's stated that he is basically allowed to do what he does is because people basically consider his work science fiction. And it's categorized as science fiction. I don't think it's sold as science fiction, but it's treated like that in Romania. And so people dismiss it. He said that he's had a hard time getting people to accept it other than as science fiction, and he insists that it's not science fiction.
I can understand why he's having a difficult time with it, but maybe the way as with your publication of it, it makes it more believable, I guess. But I would think that this would be something that they would want us to keep in that category because it's so profound. They probably want to keep it as sci-fi.
You bring up an interesting point. Because if I go back to the Montauk Project,
right,
and the time when the story was being broken, and
right,
and George was very much a part of the scene at that time,
I remember,
as the story was broken, and of course the story had been told, it had been told on video, it had been told here and there, when putting it into the book form, it was being shared by a much wider audience than it had ever been. And as the story broke, the science fiction aspect was so strong. Had that book actually, had Duncan and Preston and Al Bielek went on to the Oprah show or the Phil Donahue show, which were popular at that time,
right,
it would have shocked the people watching the show. It would have created a certain amount of social it created enough social unrest as it was.
Yeah.
It created a lot of radical conspiracy instigations and movements and all this sort of thing, which was not our intention. Our intention was to tell the story. But this goes back to the whole World of the Worlds thing with Orson Welles
and
people freaking out, because people did freak out in the state of New Jersey thinking that the Martians were attacking. And so there is a certain perhaps benign aspect to the way the government has covered up Roswell and those things. There's probably less, positive things than, but when you open up, let me explain it this way to you. When we talk about censorship is a key component of military science and what you release and what you don't release. It's all in the realm of the military and military war colleges and all this. What you tell the people. you certainly, when you're doing a military campaign, can't tell everybody what you're doing. You can't tell the public because you're going to undermine your own activity. But in the case of the human brain, Aldous Huxley, in his book Doors of Perception, referred to it by his own name as a reducing valve, whereby if you were to see everything that your brain is taking in perceptually, you can't function. And this is what happens to somebody on LSD or hallucinogenic drugs when they can't function. They're going gaga. They're like a mad person because they can't see, you know, they can't water the lawn. And Aldous Huxley referred to it as the reducing valve. So when you begin to take all the governors off, or like on a car, or the reducing valve, you cannot function properly. So if you take this off on society and you tell the truth all about the aliens and this group and everything you know, and you see the helplessness of the government versus the cards it's holding and all of these things, they're going to be ontological shock. You know, ontological, ontology has to do with the nature of being. And
well, I remember, George will remember this too. Remember that lady that we talked with, Anthony Bryce, remember? She was a member of the, worked with Ray Bradbury in the in dealing with the Council of Nine,
Ray Bradbury? Are you sure it's Ray Bradbury?
Ray Bradbury, yeah.
Science fiction author?
That's science fiction.
Science fiction author, yeah. But Ray Bradbury was part of the of the government project that actually communicated with the Council of Nine. And remember that lady that he had on his show, that Anthony had, that we spoke with? Remember her?
Oh, vaguely, yes. Mm-hmm. That was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it was even last year, actually. And she was quite elderly now, but she worked with Ray Bradbury in this government project that contacted the supposedly the Council of Nine. And much of that was later, much of what they did and much of what they discovered during that time was actually portrayed in Star Trek, all right? Much of what they
You mean Gene Roddenberry?
Oh, what did I say? Ray, yeah, Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah, Gene Roddenberry, yes.
Two
very
different people.
Yeah.
Sorry, what did I say? Ray Broddenberry?
You said Ray Bradbury.
Ray Bradbury, no, Roddenberry.
Gene Roddenberry, okay.
Roddenberry, right.
Creator of Star
Trek. She was
a
member of a group that was influencing Bradbury in his science fiction. That's all. But she was part of a group that included, you know, the Federation, a different Federation of the powers, all planet.
Right. But according to her, what she did, she was involved with that group, which was contacting this Federation, if you will, but it was Council of Nine, all right? I remember the interview. I can play it back for you one day. But the key was is that a lot of this information later became part. Later got out into the Star Trek sci-fi and the books that he wrote the television show that he did, which was part and parcel of trying to disseminate this kind of outrageous information and technology that they had, and bring it to a public awareness. But this kind of information,
you can't alter that or manipulate that. The public's going to believe what they're going to believe in. Period.
Well, what I'm saying is nine out of ten of the Star Trek fantasies there that we've seen, many of them have become true. You got tasers and you got phasers and you got rocket ships and flying saucers and everything else out there. You know,
It's very clear that the truth leaks out through science fiction. It leaks out, and some perhaps deliberately. Preston Nichols explained to me a long time ago that what happens with science fiction authors is they pick up on stuff in a sort of a telepathic resonance. They pick up on things, they pick up on, and they put it into their writing, and it becomes true. It might be true. Any time and one of the things, and being a writer, and the stream of consciousness is one of the first things I learned as a writer in school, is you start writing a journal and you start getting a stream of consciousness. And the stream of consciousness plugs into, they don't describe it that way, but what we call now the morphogenetic grid. You're plugging into the subconscious. You're plugging into not only your own subconscious, but the collective subconscious. And you begin to get action and interface. You're stretching from the infinite into the finite when you put the pen to the paper. And it's a magical process.
It really is. I think what I've seen is there's a definite magical connection to another level of consciousness when you're on that role. And I see it in your writing and in the other books that you've actually written. You've tapped into some amazing things. Especially when you spoke about your synchronicity and whatnot.
Yes, and I've realized I've got 17 books published now,
right.
Most of which I've authored or co-authored, and it's gotten to the point now where I've just realized, and my books have been studied in universities and whatnot, that I almost like to have to, and I think I know the person I want to have do it, is write an introduction to my work. It's become, in terms of its volume, it's become a little unwieldy and complex, you know, for somebody. I mean, any book is designed to be read. Somebody pick it up and read it, but it could become a whole curriculum of phenomena because it's so diverse and complex.
Your book, absolutely. From the Montauk series on up, it's been amazing stuff. And I thank George so much for bringing it to my attention and, of course, introducing me to you. But I wanted to talk briefly before we go, before we end the show. You still got about 25 minutes, but I wanted to talk about the inner earth civilization that seems to be real. I mean, it seems to be evidence that they exist. Can you talk a little bit about that or elaborate on that?
Yes, I will, and I will tell you how I learned about it. Of course, Jules Verne wrote about it in his Journey to the Center of the Earth, and there's a very delightful movie with Pat Boone and James Mason, Journey to the Center of the Earth in 1959. They've made a few others since then. But those are more Hollywoodized versions, but they're interesting. And the whole thing with Jules Verne, he was a part of, you know, secret societies and whatnot. And here again is the information is leaking out through the secret societies back then in the days of Jules Verne, and other authors of that ilk. Now, where I first made this connection was, was studying the etymology of Montauk and how it related to Mentu or Montu of Egypt, the god of war, equivalent to Mars, and how the word Cairo means Al-Kahira, which means Mars, and the connection between, at that time, the pyramids of Mars, the time I wrote the book, were becoming very well known in terms of the work that Richard Hoagland grabbed onto and then, you know, put into his own words from the pyramids that were discovered at JPL. You know, the pyramids of Mars. So anyway, so at that point there was this connection to Mars and Montauk that I was investigating, and of course Preston had some elaborate scenarios talking about Mars, which were seemed fantastical, but nevertheless it was part of the whole scenario. Now, I was working with a woman who's still my friend today. I call her Madame X in the early books. She was very genned in on specialized sorts of information. She's a very psychic gift, and she's got an intellect that, you know, you don't find it in many women, and you don't find it in many men. It's a incredible mental, I mean, she's a very pretty girl too, but I mean, it comes with this mental package, and it's quite pleasant to talk to her, because, and she liked talking to me, and we, because we could understand each other. You know, a lot of people don't quite, you know, get it with her because, you know, and so she was, I had met her on her trip out to Montauk. I had met her on her way back the first time she went out there before the book was written. And we connected up and hit it off real good. So she began to tell me of this ancient blue race that came from Mars. And she says, these are, and she does not present these to me as historical fact, but as ancient records. She would know them from ancient records. So they would be historical fact if you believe the ancient records from Egypt, hieroglyphic things. I mean, she has a real gift for knowing ancient stuff that your typical archaeologist isn't going to know anything about. And she has a deep knowledge, so she shared a lot of this with me based upon her scholarship that comes with a gift. And much of it is from that esoteric doctrine of Madame Blavatsky. And if the average person reads Madame Blavatsky, they're going to go ape because it's just so complicated.
Yeah, I've read her, and I've talked a lot about her on the programs, and you're absolutely right.
And it's written to be complicated. And I try to do the opposite. But then again, my work has become unwieldy in terms of the size of it. So, you know, complexity is something you can't avoid that easily. But to get back to it, there was much more to Madame Blavatsky than anybody's ever going to put their finger on. But because she was dealing with all of these networking of all these sort of secret societies and whatnot. And she was very astute on many points. The best way to understand Blavatsky is to go to Wikipedia and read her stuff there and get an introduction to it so you know what the heck you're reading. But anyway, that's where a lot of this information, and there was an ancient blue race in Egypt that settled
right.
Egypt, that settled Tibet, that settled, you know, the Celtic people believed in the blue race. They have they'd have the blue ceremony.
You're talking about that, I went to this chapter in your Montauk Book of the Living, which it's called the Rhesus Negative.
Right.
Developed the Rh negative or blue blood or Rh positive and Rh negatives. Maybe you can explain that a little bit in your as you talk about it. And how I'm very curious too how the and Lila mentioned it earlier to ask you about this is how the blue bloods got their name. Now they elite of the world elite, you know.
Right. Well, the Rh negative. What she had explained to me in those early days was that there is a certain blood type, she said, which is just not traceable to originating on this planet, and that was the Rh negative. And it occurs in all races. It doesn't matter which race you are. It can occur in blacks. It can occur in Chinese. And she said
thing though people should know is where Rh comes in to play and how they actually got this Rh. And it stands for rhesus. And,
rhesus factor, which is the monkey. In other words, we call it monkey blood. In other words, if you're Rh negative, Rh positive means you have monkey blood. Rh negative means you don't have monkey blood, means that there's some part of you that didn't come from the monkey. And is closely related to the Rh factor, which does exist in the blood. It's,
right.
You know, whether somebody wants to argue whether we came from apes or not, well, we're very similar to apes. So there's a factor in the Rh negative that is not similar to apes. They don't really know what it's similar to, but...
They know it's not apes, yeah.
Well, yeah, it's not on this planet. So this Rh negative is, according to the history records, it's from Mars. Mars had a whole problem with a collision, and they knew they were going to have to come to Earth because that planet went by the boards. And the civilization went underground in Mars, so because it had to, because they had problems with the collision of worlds and whatnot. It's described in the Black Sun and once again in the Montauk Book of the Living, the right. circumstances with the planetary orbits of Mars, and it goes back to the Roman calendar. And, you know, Mars was the first calendar, first month in the Martian calendar.
And I thought it was fascinating, too, that it says here that you stated that the name Rhesus, however, derives from Rhi or Rhea, which was one of the oldest goddesses in Greek mythology.
Well, that's Rhesus is, well, see, Rhea Silvea. I'm showing the word association there.
Exactly,
I don't know if Rhesus, you know, evolved from Rhea, but, well, it's very close. She was the goddess of the earth,
right.
and she was the first Vestal Virgin. And I go into the virgin birth in that book, which is tied
right.
to the Rh negative, you know, which ties us to the blue bloods of royal blood, of which, you know, would be the bloodline of Christ.
Right.
It depends how you look at it, but it's this. And now, what becomes more interesting is when blue bloods have a certain disease. And I point out that King George III, the one who supervised the revolution,
right.
or you know, England during the Revolution, the American colonies had porphyria, and it was blue bloods disease. It was called, and he was quite mad. There's a book called The Madness of King George, and he went lock, stock, and barrel crazy. And they had to put him in a straitjacket. He was so...
Yeah, so
anyway, he had blue bloods disease, and this, where you piss urine. You urinate in purple. I mean, you piss urine, obviously. It's purple urine. Purple rain, they call it. Like that song that Prince did. And only he doesn't explain what purple rain is.
I don't think he knew it. Well, it sounded
well yeah,
like
he
that.
Would have known it, or whoever, you know, wrote the song, if he didn't write the song. So anyway... Or if he's just, again, taking it off of the morphogenetic grid because of, you know, his creative muse.
Right.
But anyway, so we're talking about, you know, the Rh negative factor in the blue blood. So anyway, this goes back to Mary, Queen of Scots. George III is related to Mary, Queen of Scots, who was the first, I guess, recorded person to have this blue blood disease of porphyria. And Mary, Queen of Scots, can be traced back, her lineage, to Transylvania, which at that point in my research was just interesting because I had not been to Transylvania, but of course this goes back, Transylvania is of course associated, at least in the subconscious, with vampires and werewolves and that sort of thing. So I guess what you call hypothesis is that the Rh negative person has special abilities, and it would be tied to the 24th gene pair, which is fused in mankind. We have 23 gene pairs in mankind. We should have 24. And the blue bloods have that 24th pair activated if it's not fully present. So it gives a sort of a supernormal capacity, which if it was fully turned on, would enable one to do paranormal things like shapeshift.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to ask you a question now. With some of the findings in the inner earth there, Baluki Mountains, with the knowledge that they had of our DNA and so forth, what do you think is happening right now? Why do you think this is coming out?
Well, you know, it would have to do with the periods in, you know, the Hindu Vedas refer to as the Kali Yugas. Every 26,000 years, there is a cycle of time.
The progression
and,
of the equinox.
Yes, yes. And there are cycles of time, which they kind of go backwards to the equinox as we know it. These huge cycles of time, like, you know, people get very upset when you mention astrology sometimes. And astrology is based upon ancient observations that have gone on, and the astrology you see in the paper is very surface, but I mean the ancients studied it, and I mean we're talking about periods of 26,000 years they chronicled,
right.
And going from the age of Pisces into the age of Aquarius is, which we're now into Aquarius, is the time of enlightenment and understanding. It's the time of mankind. So Pisces was a time when all the information was buried. It was a time of darkness. So we have all knowledge receding into hidden forms. Now it's coming back out. So the knowledge of our own DNA, I mean, even the fact that you can now trace crimes by DNA, it puts a certain suppression on crime.
Okay.
You know,
The reason why I ask this is because, you know, I take a look at what happened with the Montauk Project and what came out of that in consciousness, all the different attachments that connected to it. And yet, you mentioned before, Leo, you know, Star Trek, how, you know, a lot of those things are like wormholes and so forth, they become, you know, part of our vocabulary. But it's the manifesting of consciousness that manifests them, and that basically is what's happened. Now, my question is that, you know, with all of the problems we're having right now with the environment and so forth, with tapping into underground worlds or the underground civilizations, and at the rate that this is happening, what do you think, where would you like this to turn out?
Well, where would I like it to turn out? It's a very good question, because what you're talking about is how far, you know, can you go inside of yourself? How much can you see? And this is a collective game. This whole trip has been an individual journey for myself, and that's on the internal basis. But it's also a journey that includes the collective consciousness. So, you know, other people wake up, other people pick up on the themes, they write about the themes that I've written about. It's created spin-off literature, and that's a great thing. It's actually created an effect in the world. But where would I like it to go? Well, I could only tell you that when I originally set out on this journey was to dissolve all hurtful mechanical conditions of existence. That was a definite moment I made in a decision, and my whole life changed after I made that that decision. In other words, it's sort of a bodhisattva type of approach to life, because I was in very good shape when I made that. I said, well, I can do anything I want, I decided, and what do I want to do? And I wanted to resolve, you know, it's kind of like resolving the suffering that goes on in this world. And so I would like to see that happen. I would like to see that happen. So when the information comes out, it can relieve the suffering. It can relieve the ignorance. And ignorance is one of the biggest problems. So that's where I would like to see it go.
I agree with you. That's a lofty goal. And I guess one that we're all kind of part of. We hope that what we do enlightens others, you know.
Well, let me share something.
I wouldn't say it's a lofty goal. I think we have the ability now to eradicate most diseases and even a bacteria. And we do this with frequencies. Even though years ago I gave up my psychotronics, studies and so forth, knowing that, you know, the only difference between the psychotronics device and myself is my body. But, you know, we have potentials, and I think all we have to do is focus those potentials, and they'll manifest. I mean, the same way they manifest when we create our own reality, because basically what we're saying is a reflection of us.
Let me explain what I'm saying, my lofty goal. I don't mean it unachievable, but I mean it's a worthy goal. It's a very good goal to have, and I think that you're doing a very good job with it, Peter, because these books are extremely enlightening.
Sure, yes, very good.
Let me say something about that, is that I could only make that goal when I was actually in very good shape personally and was at a high point in my life psychologically. And I'm talking about internal accomplishment. And, but what I'm saying is once I made that decision, things began to move and happen. Dynamics began to come into life that changed. Now, that doesn't mean I didn't sit at the beach for 7 years or something. I was parked for long periods of my life. I came to Long Island. It took me 7 years to find this career where I was, you know, doing various and sundry things that were sort of preparing me, not realizing I was being prepared. But my point here is that this lofty sort of thing, when one the most important thing somebody can do is get themselves healthy, get themselves mentally, physically, and emotionally healthy, and go about achieving that. Once you've done that, then you're in shape to achieve anything, and then, you know, the world can, and that's what the world needs to do. It needs to, you know, and George is talking about all these potentials. Yes, the technology, Bell Labs was renowned for having all these incredible technologies, you know, a pill that would get rid of a hangover. You talk to people that come out of there, you know, you hear all these things, and it's, how is it released to the public? This is the access. How are we going to give access? Who are we going to give access to? The technology is always 20 to 30 years ahead. So it's part of the control and issues of this planet is, how are they going to release it? Who are they going to give the contracts to? It's all very controlled. And I'm sure not all of the control is bad, but it's the way it is. And it's that reducing valve on a collective conscious, you know. The government tells us what we can know and what we can't know. And tells the president what he can know and can't know, because he's not entitled to know everything. As one person once told me that knew David Anderson as well, if not better than I did, said, you know, he's got higher security clearance than the president. And, you know, yeah. And he probably does.
Kind of like Oppenheimer with a bomb, you know.
Exactly.
I think Truman, when he came on, he didn't even know there was a bomb being built. Sure. When Truman became president, it was the Los Alamos was a complete secret. But,
yeah.
So I know what you're saying. But the thing that surprised me, and I'd like to, we only got about 4 or 5 minutes left, but I wanted to ask you, the tunnel to the inner earth and to Egypt and to Tibet. Who were they? I mean, can you identify? Have you identified who the people were that made those tunnels? Where they were from?
I would assume it's from the old Atlantean time period. It could even be older. They would be the same blue race, I would imagine.
Right.
I mean, I couldn't tell you. Preston talked about those tunnels going under Long Island and whatnot, and of the United States. They're ancient tunnels. He talked about them years ago.
I remember mentioning it, but they're under the Denver. There's a huge frame, a complex, I guess,
right.
Of tunnels under the Denver airport.
Yeah, it's gotten a lot of attention. Yeah,
most famous one. Yeah, but I don't know. I'm really looking forward to your adventures in Romania, and to hear about those and see what happens, and I can't wait to see your new book coming out. And that's going to be called what?
The new book will be called, and you know, due probably I would say January at the soonest, December if I can get it out, is going to be called Mystery of Egypt, the First Tunnel.
Mystery of Egypt, the First Tunnel. And for all of you who are listening tonight, I want to mention that Transylvanian Moon Sunrise and the second book in this series, Transylvanian Moonrise, and then the book that you just mentioned in the third book coming out probably sometime early next year. And I'm fascinated. Can't wait to read the next book. But I want to thank you. I want to thank you so much for being on again.
You're welcome. I can come back in September when I'm back.
Oh, absolutely. I can't wait to have you on. Yeah, absolutely. And, George, I want to thank you again. And I want to tell everybody that tomorrow night we have George will be on again with author Ross Hamilton as we discuss, again, the inner earth and secrets.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But Peter, thanks again. Thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure, Leo.
Always
thank you,
pleasure.
Peter.
And
thank you, George.
Everybody can go to Sky. Now everybody can go down to skybooks.usa.
Skybooksusa.com.
Skybooksusa.com. Skybooks.usa.com.
USA.com.
USA.com. And check out all the books. It's a great, great site. A lot of great books. Thanks again.
Thank you, Neil.
And we'll talk again in September.
Okay,
bye. Right. Bye-bye. And George, I want to just quickly promote our show tomorrow night. George?
Yeah, I'm still here. No, Ross Hamilton, he's wrote several books, and one of his books was the Great Serpent Mound, where he actually he's been researching the Serpent Mound in Ohio for a number of years. Has written this book on that, and his one of his other books was Traditions of Giants, which he talked about the early Americans when they came here. Lewis and Clark ran into giant-statured people, Native Americans, the living in America at that time. And he's written quite a bit about these giant people and also separated the different tribes. So he's going to talk a bit about that and hopefully maybe get into some of those hidden libraries or that Casey talked about that may be under the Serpent Mound.
That'll be excellent. Yeah, just to talk to him tomorrow. So that's
Ross tomorrow at 8 o'clock.
Right, tomorrow at 8 o'clock right here. And, George, I want to thank you, like always, and wish you the best. And we'll talk to you tomorrow night.
Okay, buddy.
Okay, have a good night.
Adios, God be with you.
Okay. And for everybody else, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed it. Again, I want to make sure that you know you can go to skybooksusa.com and pick up, check out all of Peter Moon's books. But you might want to check out the Montauk Book of the Living, which talks about the blue people and the blue race. And his latest books, The Transylvanian Sunrise, Transylvanian Moonrise, and the new one to come out in the same series in January, which is the Egyptian Tunnel, I believe, or something to that effect. But we'll have Peter on when he comes back from Romania. So I want to thank everybody and wish you a good evening. And let's see here. And I want to end with...